For members of the church, education is not merely a good idea, it's a commandment. We are to learn of things both in heaven and in the earth and under the earth, things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, things which are at home, things which are abroad.
Hello and welcome to Insights. I'm Marilee Stallings. Our guests today are John and Tamara Adams, now retired theater educators. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Our topic today is about theater and theater history. Now, for myself, I remember that my first foray into theater was a school play when I was 7 years old. I got the part of the forget-me-not flower. And I got that part because I was the only one who could pretend I was crying when I said, I don't remember. But as I recall the evening of the performance, I was trying hard not to laugh as I said my line. So theater, in one way or another, touches all of us. How did you get involved in theater? Tell us a little bit about how you got started and where it began for you.
Well, I know exactly when it was. Again, school play. School plays, church plays, that's a great way to get started at all. We were having a little Indian play, and I was a blonde girl with big blue eyes, so the teacher asked everybody who had brown hair and brown eyes to please read this little part. And I didn't know anything about acting, but I knew what they were doing was not the way it should be read. And so the teacher, just to be polite, said, is there anybody else who'd like to read? I raised my hand. She pulled everybody else and asked me last because I was the shortest, and got up, and I felt a light hit my head and through my body that said, this is who you are, and this is what you can do. And I read that little, oh, my fawn-skin papoose, you are all I have. It is you the Great Spirit wants for this sacrifice for the village. So anyway, the rest was falling in love with theater and all of its aspects of it. And
Isn't it amazing, your first play, you remember your first line?
Yes.
Yeah. Or in my case, my only line. Uh-huh. What about you, John?
Well, I'm a Navy brat, and my father happened to be a BYU graduate in drama and speech. So I had a father who was constantly giving me the opportunity of giving little talks in primary and then 2.5-minute talks. And I was doing a lot of that performing even before I went to school. And I remember once, I mean, I was in school. It was in high school. It was a speech class. And Shirley Tillery happened to be the teacher. She was, a lot of the guys signed up for this class because she was young and beautiful. And she married before the year was over. But she really gave us assignments that we wanted to do. And this assignment was a narrative poem that they wanted us to stand up and actually do a poem that told a story. And my father said, when I told him what the assignment was, he says, I've got just the thing for you. It's called Lochinvar. Oh, young Lochinvar has come out of the west. Through all the wide border, his steed was the best. And save his good broadsword, he weapons had none. He rode all unarmed, and he rode all alone. After I did that, Miss Tillery at the time says, now that is what I call an A performance. When she treated me that way, I thought, you know, this isn't bad at all. And then I just kept performing and performing and got into college theater, and the rest is history.
You are retired theater educators.
Yes.
So you taught drama in the public school systems. Where did you teach?
I taught 20 years at West Jordan High School.
Oh, my.
Yes, it was fun.
So, and how about...
Right, and I was in the Jordan School District at Albion Middle, and I taught 7 through 9 because I could teach the kids how to read as well as how to perform on a stage.
That's great. That's great. So through those years, you not only did a lot of directing, obviously.
Yes.
Directed a lot of plays. What do you do now?
We both direct at Hale Center Theater and have since 1989. And John?
You also direct for Hale Center.
I direct at Hale Center.
So even though you're retired, you're still working.
Right. I'm afraid we haven't retired from the workaday world. We are working at Hale Center Theater. We've been there for 21 years. We're working on our 43rd production. We love being there. And
theater is just in your blood. Once you get started, it's kind of hard to stop.
Yes. Once you have gotten the bug, you just never really seem to get over it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about theater history. How did theater get started? How old is theater?
As old as man is telling stories to his wife or his friends. Theater's anywhere.
Well, the thing that's interesting, as I was just doing a little research, I can remember my classes in college, you know, going over this, but they said that no group of people, even tribes or clans, didn't have some kind of a belief in a superhuman power. And they go in, the anthropologists and the sociologists, and they find all of these evidences of what it was that they were doing as they worshipped these gods that they actually invented,
yes,
based on looking at the world and what happened in it with its order and its majesty and its beauty. And then, of course, they realized that there were things going on between them as people. And as a result, they started worshiping, and these worship services turned out to be quite dramatic.
People have an innate desire for entertainment. And it became some of the very first, the processions and the pageantry, it became some of the very first entertainment along with worship.
And when you look at the golden ages of the theater, I mean, the first theater, we don't do very much with Egyptian, but we do really look at the cradle of Western civilization, which was Greece. And we know that they had a god by the name of Dionysus, and their cult and their worship became quite animated and wonderful. And before long, they brought in theater. I mean, a theater that allowed people to write plays, compete for prizes, and develop people who were in orchestras who could sing and who could dance.
Notice that what he's mentioning are all group activities, group choruses, group sayings. Not till Thespis stepped out to speak alone do we have acting actually begin.
So everything, those original then Greek pageants or Greek
worship,
religious presentations were hymns almost.
Yes.
Like you had a chorus. In fact, that's a word that we use today for a choir. This is the chorus. And they're singing together as a group. And I think it's interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. They also danced in Greek theater.
Yes, in groups.
Well, they had flute, interludes, and all of these kinds of things. But they really, really made it a musical. I mean, we don't really think of tragedy as a musical. But when you realize that you had these choruses and they were talking back and forth with Thespis being the first actor to step out of the chorus and to say lines himself, and before long he was talking to then the head of the chorus, and then other writers, Sophocles and Aeschylus, brought in other actors. We had two or three actors. And it allowed them to have this opportunity of searching for the truth that they were looking for. And they didn't do any of these plays at any other time of the year. I mean, plays were restricted for this religious worship. That's what's interesting.
Well, I think also what's interesting is I've been reading the Bible, and as I've been going through the Bible, and especially in Numbers, it talks about the building the temple in Jerusalem, and there are three orders of priests. You have the priests who actually perform the sacrifices, then you had the singers who sang the hymns, and then you had the porters who were responsible for collecting the donations and getting those distributed where they needed to go. And I was always intrigued by this, that there were singers that were singing hymns in the temple. So there was a presentation and a performance, a religious presentation of music and chorus and singing that was associated with the temple worship in Jerusalem. And so this was not a new thing. This was going on all throughout the Mediterranean.
Yes, it was. It really became only because they brought so many people in. It was there at the end of March, beginning of April, and they sat literally on the side of a mountain. We've seen some of these places now, like Epidaurus and these places in Greece.
The Colosseum's cut into the the hillside and step seating. You know?
And these people came, I mean, for a five-day festival. I mean, so they brought their food, they picnicking, I guess, there on the hillside, and they watched these stories. Now, remember, these stories that the Greeks were listening to, they knew very well. They had been developed over the last 700 years. So they knew what they were going to be told. They just did not know how it was going to be told.
How was it going to be presented? What was the set going to be? Mm-hmm. What were the costumes going to be?
Right. But they wanted to know, because you had good writers. I mean, they came in and they made meaning out of these mythology stories. And so as they watched, particularly with the tragedies, as Aristotle mentioned, he said the audience will feel fear, they will feel pity. Pity for the suffering that these protagonists, these heroes, have to go through. But most of them are putting themselves either above or beyond God. And they're trying to show the people how you don't put yourself above the gods. And as a result, they go through all of this suffering. And because it's a tragedy, they have to fail. They have to die, or they have to be ostracized from society or blinded or whatever. But the thing is, before it is over, Aristotle talks about a catharsis. And the catharsis is the enlightenment that comes to everybody on that mountainside who is realizing, I've got to live better than I am, because if I do what this person on the stage is doing, the gods could perhaps do the same thing to me. But they never thought that it was a senseless suffering. They realized why he had to go through it, because he wasn't in the right position between he and his
God. He's made a mistake, and now he's got to pay for it and suffer the consequences. And the audience, if it's done right, is made to feel very deeply for that character. And they learn from watching him suffer and look at their own life and their own mistakes, thinking that this is portraying real life and things that could really happen.
What was the purpose of the mask?
To be seen.
To be heard.
And to be heard. Excellent. I mean, now what they call the onchus, and it makes the mask near the forehead really big and broad. You've got to remember they're a long way away from these actors, and so
PA systems like we have today.
And they had no PA systems. But in order for you to see their heads or their faces or to be aware, and of course it was a very big movement they would have to do, and that's the reason why probably what they said was rather declamatory and broad and open. But they had these great big masks that they would put on. And they would have male masks and female masks.
And they had sticks extending in their hands, so the costume would hang from the end of the sticks so that they'd be in high heels.
To make the emotion bigger.
Yes. They needed to be bigger than life to try to play to the 25,000th person there in the Colosseums.
That's what they had to do.
And the vocal part, yeah. You'll talk
and because they didn't have a microphone like we have here in front of us as we're doing this in the studio, they took copper and they put it on the inside upper part of the mouth. Now, you've got to remember, they had to get tremendous voices out of the people that were there. Just not
very
anybody.
Strong diaphragms.
Very, very strong diaphragms and wonderful voices. But they would get that piece of copper vibrating, and you would be surprised how much further their voices went up that mountainside with that vibrating copper.
So it created a megaphone effect of enormous
sound. It had been a little metallic, but they said that these actors were really quite good.
Wow.
But in order for them to be heard, this is what they had at their disposal. The other thing that was interesting, I mean, the girls today, I noticed, love to wear these great big high heel
yes.
shoes and they're walking around. Well, that's exactly what the Greek actors had. They were called catherni, and they were great big laced-up boots, but they were more like stilts.
Yeah, in between platform stiletto heels and stilts, yes.
So that they were much higher. So they were higher, they were broader, and they were longer with these tremendous voices. And that's what it was that they had to have in order for the people to hear the story, understand the story, and relate to the story.
Wow. So moving along, then we get into what I call the Roman spectacle. I'm sure that they actually did Roman plays, but what most of us are familiar with are the Roman spectacles that happened in the Colosseums.
Yes.
I think this started with the Greeks, imitating the Greeks,
oh, yes.
and then got bigger and bigger.
Well, this is exactly, almost everything Rome had, they stole, if we may use the word, from the Greeks. The thing that was interesting about the Greek plays and why you had all these messengers in them is that they never let you see the blood and the gore. They came onto the stage and they told you these wonderful stories and these very long speeches, which actors just love having to memorize today. But that's what they would do. They would not let you see the carnage on the stage. Or they would have tableaus or this other kind of a thing, not on the stage, but on a platform near the stage, that would let you know about action that was happening not there on the stage or somewhere outside of the building. This is the way they did it. But you go to Rome, and they brought all of the fighting, the blood, the gore, the eyes that were taken out. And as a result, historians of theater don't think that they're quite as wonderful a theater golden age as was the Greeks.
Thank you for tuning in to the Mormon Channel Radio. You're listening to Insights. Our guests today are John and Tamara Adams, and our topic is theater history. How did our modern theater evolve? We go from the Greek huge expansion, everything's big, to the Roman spectacle. We head through the Middle Ages with the morality play.
The reason for the morality plays is that the the priests convinced the people that actors were evil and they were not to be made famous for the children to look up to. So they said theater is outlawed, period. So they started doing pageants at church, and then they took them on the road with pageant wagons. And so they could do theater if they did Bible stories.
Ah.
And those got to be puffed up, and they'd make fires for the flame and smoke, and everybody loved a story about hell. There was devils and things you don't see every day, the forbidden.
Yeah, they seem to be rather preoccupied with demons and devils and hell in the Middle Ages.
We've always been. Hmm. Look at the films today. My goodness gracious.
Okay.
The thing that is important also is that there was no print. And these people's salvation was dependent on the church and the priests. They didn't have a Bible like we have
even
today.
Even the priests hadn't read all the Bibles back then.
Which is true. They hadn't. But they didn't know the stories. They didn't know the doctrine. And the only way that the church could actually let the people know what the basic doctrinal, things were that they wanted them to live by, they had to go out and they had to tell the story of Adam and Eve or Noah and the flood or the Tower of Babel or whatever. And that's exactly what they did. They started on their church steps and then they finally, as Tammy mentioned, took them out on the road in these pageant wagons. But they were very, very effective, and it was a way for an ignorant Bible society to know what was in the Bible and what it was that they were to live up to.
And people were hungry for entertainment, so they would come out in droves for any circus or any minstrel or any storyteller, let alone a big religious pageant.
Right, without any radio or television, they didn't have a whole lot to do. So somebody coming into town
other than work.
On a show,
they found a way.
They love having somebody come and do something for them.
So how did we then get from these morality plays to modern theater? Was there a
Renaissance.
The Renaissance. And I think the Renaissance was important because that's when they began to discover these old Greek manuscripts and the Greek plays.
Yes.
That's when they returned back to them. They realized how really wonderful the Greek writers and all of their paraphernalia. I mean, we're still using their words, their mm-hmm. orchestra, their prosceniums, their paradoses, I mean, that we come on and off with, the periskene, the wings. I mean, all of this stuff we're still using today. When the Elizabethans actually got back into the original copies of these plays written by these wonderful Greek writers, they realized what a wonderful thing it was that they had.
So good that they wanted to then put them into their vernacular. And the poets and the writers did just that.
And at that time, you had Christopher Marlowe and Ben Jonson and William Shakespeare. And the Lord put them there, I believe, mm-hmm. at this time, so that they were going to be able to write these wonderful things, you know, based on these wonderful scripts that had been created by the Greeks. One thing I wanted to say about this, if I could, from maybe a Mormon point of view, is that at the same time all of this kind of thing was going on in Greece, in our Bible, we have Israel leaving Egypt and going back to Canaan and taking over the land that the Lord had given to them. And they were there, you know, for what, 700 years. They were there for 700 years before it came time for the 10 tribes to be disseminated and thrown out. In all of that time, the Greeks were developing all of this mythology that they finally put up onto the stage. It was interesting to me that the Lord allowed the Greeks to develop all of this wonderful theater and this wonderful society because he had his chosen people who were not following him and that which he asked them to do. And so he literally had to give the Greeks the opportunity of bringing all of this wonderful culture that would bless the world for a long, long time and did not give it to his own people, whom he could very easily have done. And I've always felt that because they weren't ready and they weren't obedient, the Lord just gave this opportunity to another great people to develop this kind of literature and work.
And we know the different kinds of theater. We know that there are plays, musicals, pageants. I think most LDS people will understand the word pageant. We know what that is. Especially if you're here in Utah during the summer season, there are plenty of pageants that you can go and see.
And they're good, too.
Yeah, some of them are very, very good. Yes. Let's talk a little bit about the musical. What makes a musical? Is it an outgrowth of opera? Is opera an outgrowth of...
Yes, it's... People love music, and they love a story. It comes from plays and from vaudeville, and all the different musical acts, lots of variety. I would venture to say that vaudeville was more popular than just plays, even though plays are wonderful.
Well, vaudeville was a variety show.
Yes, it was, and it was just more fun. All right, so they started doing big Broadway musicals. I'll put that in quotes.
This was about what time?
Oh,
what time
I'm
period
sorry.
Were you looking
I'm thinking
at?
About 1800s.
Well, yes. Well, they were doing.
They started the minstrel shows, operas. The vaudeville was, like you say, a variety show. It was everything. So, but people loved a story, so they put on plays with a story, and then they would stop the story and sing a popular song. It had nothing to do with the story. But then somebody got the idea to let's write songs that carry the story forward. and explain the character more and get the audience to care about that character and what happens to them. So then we start with Showboat. I believe that was the one that's touted as the beginning of American musical theater, which is truly an American invention, and where they stop and sing Bill. And she talks about this man who's just ordinary, but she adores him. He's not much to look at, but she adores him. And gets you to really care about their relationship. Then the big one is Oklahoma, which came along in the 1940s and became, it's still incredibly popular. People hear the word Oklahoma, they go, ho-hum. But then they go see it, and they fall in love with it all over again.
And I think what was unusual with Oklahoma is it actually started out with a song. That's the first thing that happens is, oh, what a beautiful morning.
Yes.
And that's what made that such a surprise for audience goers.
Oh, they just loved it. From the very first note of their theatrical musical evening was, oh, what a beautiful morning, sung without music, just gave him a pitch, and sung without music for that first few phrases, and then the orchestra came in under him and led the story forward, and it was just such a revelation to them.
And I think you're right. I think that Americans particularly have fallen in love with the musical, and I think that's a form that's probably gone out into the world.
Oh, yes. Popular all over the world. But all of the plays always had music. You think of the Japanese theater way back, and I know very little about no theater or kabuki, but they had stringed instruments behind those pantomimes. So people have always loved music tied in to whatever's going on. A storyteller, a minstrel, augmenting his stories with music, a little happy trill or sad, slow plunks, etc.
The thing that was important to remember, that there was a time before the musical became popular. Popular music was really very important to the Americans. And you had all of these people that were writing Tin Pan Alley, and they were writing all of these songs, and they were making money off of sheet music and all of it. So when they were first going on to Broadway, you didn't have much of a plot. And they made kind of fun of the really insipid plots, boy meets girl, boy
yes.
loses girl, boy gets girl. But there was nothing really inside of them but the music. I mean, to listen to some of Jerome Kern's, you know, earlier, Victor Herbert. Of course, he was more operetta. But you had these wonderful songs, Cole Porter, and they made money with it. But there was no doubt about it. After a while, the world just grew up. And they wanted to have something more than just a really dumb plot. They wanted to have something better. And as Tammy said, I mean, they just got this Green Grow the Lilacs by Lynn Riggs and decided to take this wonderful play and put music to it. And Oklahoma in 1943 was born. And we've never been the same since. And it is nice to realize that it is one, you know, invention that is in the arts that are uniquely ours.
That's uniquely American.
Yes.
Yes.
You're listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel Radio. We're discussing theater history with John and Tamara Adams. Could you talk about milestones in theater, trends that changed it drastically?
Well, okay. Let's talk about the style of acting.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt about it. When we finally got electricity, and we needed to have something that was not so loud and bombastic and that kind of thing which we were seeing on the stage, we had to have more of a naturalistic approach, that we sounded more like people in conversation rather than politicians at a political rally. And that's what a lot of the actors on a stage sounded like.
Because they had to throw that voice out and hit the balcony clear up there.
I mean, there was a reason for it, and there's nothing wrong about it. But Tammy and I have had the opportunity of hearing some of these old actors perform.
Let me give you just a little example of that. Hold your thought. Don't forget. Very important. We listened to Learning Shakespeare, and they were talking about the elocutionary style. Well, I had no idea how far it went. This old, very ham actor, but they had no electronics. They had no microphones.
No PA system.
So he would in huge, sonorous tones. He was suffering now. Othello, he had killed Desdemona and realized now he was wrong in doing so. And so his suffering sounded, I'm not exaggerating, like Desdemona! Desdemona! Just unreal.
But that was the acting of that day.
Really, yes. They had no, for little Susie Housewife out in the West, who was hungry for a play, good story, she would weep for this man's suffering. It's a great story.
I think that maybe that's why they called melodramas melodrama.
Yes.
Because they were on that style.
Oh, it was.
Well, they were, and they would have their violins in the audience. Well, in the orchestra, and they would be playing all
that
of this.
For real.
And so if you were sitting and listening to Peg of My Heart, you were going to hear a violin someplace else. But when Tam and I heard all of these Shakespearean actors, and we thought they were so wonderful, and they were wonderful in their time, mm-hmm. but they were so overly dramatic. And today, of course, nobody would stand for it.
Right.
Absolutely not. So electricity had a great deal to do with the way actors acted. The thing that was interesting, though, to me, 400 years before electricity, William Shakespeare already knew what natural acting was all about. And he told all of his actors, will you stop doing all of this clodhopper, bellowing, bombast stuff, because it isn't real.
It isn't good.
And that's what's interesting and why we keep going back to this master, because he already knew how actors should act. Hundreds of years before they ever got to it.
Oh, he even said in it's Hamlet, right?
Yes.
They're right. Hamlet, it's his speech to the players.
And it's Shakespeare giving acting lessons.
Do you remember it?
I'm going to try. Speak the speech, I pray you, as I have pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. But if you mouth it, as many of your players do, I had as lief the town crier spoke my lines. Now do not saw the air too much with your hand thus, but use all gently. For in the very torrent, tempest, and as I may say, whirlwind of your passion, you must acquire and beget a temperance that may give it smoothness. Oh, it offends me to the soul to hear a robustious, pyruic-pated fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, to split the ears of the groundlings, who for the most part are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise. I would have such a fellow whipped for o'erdoing termagant. It out Herod's Herod. That's enough.
Okay.
That's excellent. And we also mentioned, you know, that with electricity, being able to not only help the actor become a more subdued actor rather than this great overblown, it created things that we could do now with the stage. What did we have before electricity? How did they light a stage?
Well, they had lanterns.
Dangerously, yes.
Yeah.
They had lanterns, and you've got to understand a lot of theaters burned down because of the fire situation. But they would use lanterns, and then they got limestone. And limestone, of course, could burn very hot and give you an incandescent light. And that's exactly what they started to do. And they would put these lime lights at the foot of the stage.
Mm-hmm.
But they could then do a curved kind of a mirror, and they could shoot these incredible, you know, lights onto the stage, which they had not been able to do before. And it was very, very effective. But you have to understand, the Greeks did things in nighttime during daylight because they had no way on earth to do a nighttime scene.
So all of their performances were during the day?
Always. And here, now we're inside, we're getting inside theater buildings, and they have to have something to light it, particularly when it's dark. And so that's what they did. But they found limestone, and they would ignite it, and it would glow. The thing that was interesting, this is just a sidelight, but limestone would burn a little green. Burned a little green. And today, actors meet in a green room.
Oh.
And they absolutely say the reason why they called it the green room, because the cast of the limelight that was all over the stage made the walls look like they were in a green room waiting to come on.
Oh,
from
my.
From the limestone.
So that's where the green room and the limelight and all of that comes from.
It comes from.
Well, so, they used to change their costumes out on the green, too, and a lot of time of history, medieval, et cetera, out in the grass.
Oh, the grass.
And so, mm-hmm. Yes, with the limelight.
But that's what they did. And it was only until then, I mean, they literally were using that kind of lighting until gas. Remember, the gas came, and they had all of that tubing, and they would put it all around. And that was
dangerous, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can't remember. I think I remember. I'm trying to remember the years, Marilee, but I think somewhere around 400 theaters burned down in a 20-year period.
Well, and I'm even aware of I remember reading an article about a ballerina who her tutu. She got too close to a gas light. Her tutu caught flame and she burned. Oh. And so it was very dangerous for these performers to perform on these kinds of stages.
Yes.
Absolutely. They just didn't have it contained yet.
Yeah.
They needed it, but it was dangerous.
And so electricity was a real milestone for theater. They were able to do performances at night after people had finished working. And that probably created a whole new culture in and of itself.
Exactly. The other thing, too, about electricity, not only the light, but you have to understand that before electricity, everything on the stage had to be moved by hand. Mm. You had to have stage crew, stage hands. They had to move everything on and off, and it took time. Now with electricity, you could bring things down from the fly system. You could bring things up under from the stage. And it was a wonderful thing. Electricity allowed scenery to take on a whole new life of its own.
Wow. This is Insights on the Mormon Channel Radio. Our topic today is theater and theater history. Our guests are John and Tamara Adams. John and Tamara, what is your favorite type of theater? Who are your favorite playwrights?
I love a good story. I love a good musical. But if it had to come down to favorites, and starting with Shakespeare, because he's got mighty stories.
The master.
Told about bigger-than-life people. But I like All My Sons by Arthur Miller. I think it's my favorite one. What's yours?
There was one playwright that I came to know and to love, even though he's not really big and famous. His name is William Saroyan. He was an Armenian that came and lived in Northern California. And he did write a play that won the Pulitzer Prize for literature. So he wasn't any slouch. But he did more prose writing, is what he did. But the thing was, is that being introduced to him and that Pulitzer Prize, it was called The Time of Your Life. That was the name of the play. And, of course, I had done some of his one-act plays. I remember his Heart, My Heart's in the Highlands, and some of this. And this man was, he just felt to me so Mormon. Even the critics called all of his characters the beautiful people. There was just something about the humanity of the people that he write.
Salt of the earth.
And I remember my mother and father when I was growing up, because I'm a war baby. And he wrote a book called The Human Comedy. And it was put into a movie with Mickey Rooney as the telegram, messenger boy. And it was a beautiful, beautiful movie. And showed what it was like to be home, sending your young boy off to the war and losing him.
Was it a well-done movie?
Oh, yes. You can look it up in any of the movie guides, and it's down with its 3 or 4 stars. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. And I studied it with my 9th and 10th graders for years as an educator, because I could share something of my own life with a time that they never really could relate to, World War II. But the thing was, with this one particular play, he showed how people need to be human beings. And I know that's why he probably got the Pulitzer for it. But he writes a prologue in front of it that was brought to me from BYU. I was still in high school when the bishop's daughter, who had just returned from BYU, gave a talk, and she made me aware of this play. And, of course, it changed my whole life. And I've used it forever because it has more to do, I think, with our living as human beings than of actors just being on the stage. Though I think he was trying to tell actors also the way they need to live off of the stage as well as on it.
I love that quote you have from that. Would you give us that?
Well, the prologue goes like this. In the time of your life, live, so that in that good time, there will be no ugliness or death for yourself or for any life your life touches. Seek goodness everywhere. And when it is found, bring it out of its hiding place and let it be free and unashamed. Place in matter and in the flesh the least of the values, for these are the things that hold death and must pass away. Encourage virtue into whatever heart it might have been driven into secrecy and sorrow by the shame and terror of the world. Ignore the obvious, for it is unworthy of the clear eye and kindly heart. Be the inferior of no man, nor of any man be the superior. Remember that every man is but a variation of yourself. No man's guilt is not yours, nor is any man's innocence a thing apart. Despise evil and ungodliness, but not men of ungodliness and evil. These, understand, have no shame in being kindly and gentle. But if it comes in the time of your life to kill, kill and have no regret. In the time of your life, live, so that in that wondrous time you shall not add to the sorrow and misery of this world, but shall smile to the infinite delight and mystery of it. That's William Saroyan, and I love the way he writes. I love what he teaches us to do as human beings. And I wish he'd written more plays and less short stories and books.
And there lies the power, I think, of theater. In spite of movies and television, why do you think people still attend the theater?
In increasing numbers. Well, maybe because of movies and television and the lack of real content. Really good stories. They're just shocking stories. They're... Well, some of the old movie actors, as they got older and saw what was happening to their field, said, "It's disgusting." I don't know how many I've heard use that term. Oh, it's just become disgusting.
On a talk show, just to say this, some of these old actors that were in the golden age of Hollywood, they said it's much more interesting to watch silent victories over temptation than it is to see the diseases and the immoralities and the conditions of people that are depraved. And there's so much of that that are in the scripts of today's writers that you don't get to get to the good part of the human spirit and all the things that they confront in the world and they overcome. And those, they think, are the stories that were worth telling. In the Golden Age, they wrote those kinds of stories. But today, we're not finding as many of them being written. And I think that's the reason why many of the people in our society go to the theater, because the theater is still reviving these wonderful plays with these wonderful people, these wonderful struggles. And they realize this is what makes me feel like a human being and glad that I'm human, glad that they are human. And I'm going to walk out of here and I'm going to do something about it. How many movies, after you've seen the car crashes or you've seen the bedroom scenes, do you walk out feeling like, man, that makes me feel wonderful?
In other words, people are still looking for the morality play.
They really are.
Excellent, Merrily. Yes. That's exactly what they're looking for. I mean, you know, the Force in Star Wars, I mean, you got to have it. I mean, you got to do it without all the gimmicks. And that's who we are and what we're yearning for.
Oh, yes. In films, they take 113 shots of a scene to get it perfect.
But when you go to live theater, the shoe may drop.
That's right. And so you rehearse and rehearse and rehearse in live theater, because there's a saying that amateurs practice till they get it right. Professionals practice till they can't get it wrong.
But it even happens with the professionals. Of course, you've got professional actors that don't act professionally. I can remember a Katharine Hepburn story where she was known to just be unperturbable. You couldn't get her off. And because she had this reputation, there was this unscrupulous actor that came onto the stage with her and had told the sound man in the middle of her long speech, "I want you to ring the telephone." And this is in New York, in front of, you know, good-paying customers and all of this. But anyway, she is in the middle of this wonderful speech, and the phone rings. And he makes sure, of course, that she's near the phone. That's what he told the sound man. And so she picks it up, and she says, "No, she's not at home now, or he's not at home," and hangs up the telephone and, you know, looks at the other actor saying, "What is happening? Did they lean on? What's going
speaking.
On?" Exactly. So anyway, she continues on with the speech, and she comes around another angle near the phone, and the phone rings again. And she can't believe it. Now, her professionals are coming out, and she's really, she answers the phone and says, "Yes? Who is it?" "No, you have the wrong number," and hung it up. And then later on in the scene, on another speech, she's near the phone and the phone rings. And what happens? Now, by this time, the audience is, I mean, they're aware.
They're on their, they're on the edge of their seat.
What is going on? But this woman
is
holding, this woman is holding on. And she picks up the phone and she said, "Oh, yes, yes, he's right here," handing him the phone. And the audience cheered because they finally got what was going on. And the guy just crumbled. But it's a very famous story about the bloodthirstiness of an audience. They love to see things that has been practiced so long and everything, nothing can go wrong. They like to see a few mistakes once in a while.
You better get it right on stage because you can't do a redo.
And that's, I think that's why people love to go to the theater. Well, John and Tamara, thank you so much for being with us today. And to all of you theater buffs and seekers of knowledge, be sure to log on to radio.lds.org, where you can listen to individual episodes or subscribe to receive podcasts of new episodes as they come available. You've been listening to Insights on the Mormon Channel Radio. I'm Marilee Stallings.